Welcome. You're listening to the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast, live from the Fly Fishing Show in Pleasanton, California. Fly Fishing Journeys is proud to be broadcasting live from the event and having great conversations with many of the finest fly fishing and fly tying experts in the world. You can find these podcasts posted to our website, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and Facebook. To stay up to date with these and other Fly Fishing Journeys adventures, please be sure to follow and subscribe. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
As a 10-year-old on the Pacific coast of California, Fred Quintari would tie flies and share them with his fly fishing teachers. In his high school years, he learned how to build fishing rods. At 19, he went to work for Lamaglass in sales and design. He went on to be a guide in Alaska and fished on the FLW Pro Bass Tour for 5 years. He now serves as rod designer for Douglas Outdoors. We caught up at the Pleasanton, California Fly Fishing Show and learned about the fly rod design process. Fred shared some great stories about guiding in Alaska and fishing in over 50 countries. We finished with a bird's eye view on the differences between each series of the Douglas fly rods. Fred is a fun guy, and it's quite evident he cares about people enjoying fishing. That's his passion in rod design. He wants people to have great experiences when fishing. When we connected at the Tackle Dealer Show, he got wind that I was heading to Montana to fish the Missouri River after the show. He proceeded to hand me a Sky Series 7 weight to use on the trip, as he said it would be perfect for the mow this time of year. And just as you will hear him explain about the Sky Series, he was right on. Medium fast action, lighter than my other 7 weights, it casted like a dream and played big fish perfectly. Don't tell Fred, but I took the Sky 7 on the recent Steelhead King Salmon trip as well. Let's jump into the podcast, but before I do, I want to thank our sponsors. Show season starts January 3rd in Denver, Colorado. You can find all the details on the 7-location nationwide tour at flyfishingshow.com. I love my Norvice rotary vise. I had never used a rotary vise before, and it has made all the difference in the world. Do you use a rotary vise? Have you thought about getting one? Winter is a huge time to tie flies. You can find out about this fantastic tying system at nor-vice.com. Now let's get into the pod.
We are excited to be here in Pleasanton, California. I'm thrilled to have Fred Quintari, rod designer with Douglas Rods. Fred, thanks for being on our show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What goes into developing a fly rod?
When it comes to rods, they all do different things. So basically, you're looking at the span of, like, let's say 2 to 12 weight is pretty common.
Sure.
There's 1 weights and there's 15 weights and 18 weights for, you know, sharks and things like this. But for the most part, rods are trout rods, and then you go up into pike and, you know, the saltwater thing. So they all have different intended uses. The elements of design basically are weight, strength, castability, fish fighting, hardware, balance. So there's a lot of elements that go into it. And with their intended usage, there will be things like an 8-weight is made to throw a clouser or a big popper or fish in the wind in saltwater, whereas you're not going to fish that same thing on a 4-weight. So that's more delicate, maybe 8'6", dry fly, small nymphs, things like that. And with light tippets, you can't have it too fast, otherwise they snap. Right. So there's a lot of things that go into the thought process of going forward. So basically what happens in rod building or rod design is the actual building of the blank, which is the first and real most important thing, material, glass or graphite, basically. There's, of course, bamboo. That's a whole nother class, and those people are true craftsmen. Same thing with the glass and the graphite. The glass is slow, mostly. And graphite typically is faster. So between the two, we meet kind of in the middle. I like to build rods that have a little give. You can feel the fish versus just fast to the tip. Sometimes those are great casting rods, but they're not often the great fishing rods. So,
Fred, let me ask you, how do you create that in the graphite? How do you create it where it's strong and then it gets with more give towards the top? So what goes into working that graphite to do that? How does that happen?
So the stiffness and so everything is done with graphite fibers in the case of this, or what is called a glass scrim. And then there's glues, and they're called binders or matrix. And how you deal with those is what makes the rod. So it can be lower modulus towards the tip, more flexible, less breakage. towards the butt, usually that's where you want your strength and lifting power, and so that typically ramps up in modulus.
Talk about modulus. What does that word mean in rod design?
So what it means is the higher the number, so light and stiff is high modulus, slower and softer is low modulus. So you can blend, you can lay up your on axis different graphites to come up with what would be the best combination for between the tip and the butt.
So is it the diameter? Does that have to do with it, the diameter of the graphite?
It does. So just like with a a fancy sports car, everything is super light.
Mm-hmm.
But guess what? It's fragile. So the marriage between durability and function becomes very important.
Yep.
So the more expensive rod is, the higher the likelihood of breakage is. So
the more expensive the rod, the higher likelihood that that may break based upon the fragileness of the material.
Correct, because it's at the, usually at the very top end, you're pushing the limits.
Interesting.
Now, that's changing a little bit, but not to a degree like you're like, oh, super material. That hasn't happened yet.
So obviously when you buy that high-end rod, you want to look for a warranty.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. But the performance characteristics can be very nice. So light and strong in the hand, or light and fast in the hand. Typically, they don't have to be fast, but lighter in the hand for sure. More responsive, like a sports car. So when you come back down, and you and I talked yesterday about the difference between higher-end cars and lower-end cars. So Toyota, for instance, built a great car. Still does to this day. But in the beginning of the Lexus, people didn't understand that that was also a Toyota, just a high-end Toyota.
Right.
So we do the same thing with our rods. Like our top-end rod is the Sky Series. It's still a good fishing rod. It's not wicked fast, but it's faster than the rest. It's got some special resins and really nice hardware. So beautiful performance tool with the marriage of some strength behind it. Because I don't, that's a warranty issue.
Yeah.
And then when you go all the way to the other end of the spectrum with us, we have the LRS series, which is a brand new series we came out with this year, which is of the most proven graphite of all time, Graphite 2. So it's a little bit slower, much tougher. And when you're learning, those are good elements to have in the rod.
That sounds awesome. I want to bring in some of the differentiations between the series of Douglas in a bit. But before we do that, let's talk a bit about like the scrim you mentioned. Now that's like the pole?
So a layer within. So basically how the whole thing starts is you have a steel rod, a tapered steel rod. Let's just say that's called the mandrel.
The mandrel.
Okay. Over that, you use something called prepreg, which is glue and graphite, potentially the glass scrim, etc., and it's cut into the shape of a flag. And then that is tacked on to the...
The shape of a flag.
Yes, a pennant.
Like a triangular flag.
Long, long pennant. So with that, then that's tacked on to the edge. The very edge of it is tacked onto the mandrel. Then it's rolled onto the blank under consistent pressure. And then from there, it goes into what would be called a tape machine. And it's like a cellophane tape that goes all the way down the edge of the blank. So if you see rods from the past, and certainly some now that have unfinished, when you see that rough edge,
yeah,
it looks like all the way down. A lot of Orvis rods were made in the past like that, and some Scott rods. We particularly don't do that. We don't do that with any of our series, but it's fine if you do. So basically, that's the what is left after they pull the cellophane tape off after the baking. So I skipped a couple of steps, but once you put it in the cellophane, then you hang that in the oven and you bake it. So that's what happens. Though the solids become liquids, and then the glues spread out throughout the blank, and then it cools down, and that's when you break it free from that mandrel, and you have that hollow tube, which is the blank.
That's super cool.
Yeah, so thin at one end, thicker at the other, thicker wall at one end, thinner wall at the other.
So that mandrel must get down to super thin at the
top. Super thin, and you have to treat them very carefully.
Because the mandrel could break.
Or bend.
Yep. Yeah.
Take a set. So that's going to happen in your blank as well.
Oh, boy.
So
you don't want that.
You can use them for a long time. You just have to treat them carefully.
Yeah.
So that's how you build the blank. And then from there, there's a lot of things like, what do we want this rod to do? Do we want it to throw big indicators and nymphs or great big flies? Or do we want it to be delicate for panfish and little tiny poppers and things like that, or trout flies.
Do you guys build your blanks?
We build our blanks in conjunction with the factories in both Korea and China. We build all of that over there. We build some reels here in the U.S., but all of our blanks are built offshore. Eventually, we have a facility in New York.
Yep.
We have all the equipment. We do our testing and layups and things there. We do all our production across the pond.
And you go there?
I do go there. I've been there quite a bit lately, and it's 16-hour flight from the West Coast back and forth over to where I work over there. I've known the people there for a long time.
Yep.
I've been working with them, you know, 25 years in a lot of cases. So neat people, and they know what they're doing. So some of the best rods in the world are made in other places other than the U.S.
Yeah.
Not to say one's better than the other, but they're equally as good.
And that must be interesting for you to travel over there, oversee some of the production, see how things are going, give instruction.
Yes, yes. All of the above. We learn together. So as we learn through the years with new materials and new hardware and new techniques like switch rods and spay rods and the check nymphing and different things like that that yeah. are more important today than they ever have been. And, you know, some fly shops sell only spay rods and switch rods,
right.
which is crazy, or a big percentage of their rods. So
sure.
it used to be, you know, 9 foot, 9 foot six.
Single-handed.
4, 5, and 6 single-hand rods. That's it.
Let's go back to the beginning here, because you actually started guiding in high school.
I did.
Where were you? Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Northern California in the wine country, Mendocino County, Ukiah, Fort Bragg.
You're kidding. I was just in Mendocino on the way down.
Yeah.
A great little town.
Good spot. We had salmon steelhead. We had stripers in Lake Mendocino. One lake over, we had Clear Lake, which is of the top three best bass lakes in the country. So fishing all the way growing up. Also hunting and horses and things of this nature, but fishing was it for me. Like, that's the big deal.
How did you get started? Who got you hooked on fishing?
So both my parents and my teachers always encouraged me. I used to tie flies for teachers when I was young, you know, as young as 10 years old. And then I started to just finish rods when I was in high school. So
that's amazing.
I would build up a Lamaglass blank or an old Fenwick blank. Those were the big names at the time. I built them for teachers all the way into college, and then just I stayed with it. And, you know, at 19, I went to work with Randy Swisher, hired me on at Lamaglass, both in sales and helping in design. And so I kind of learned my way through the blank process. And a bunch of companies later, including Reddington along the way, and now, obviously, with Douglas. I'm 52 now, and so quite a few years ago.
Yeah, this is in your blood. You've been building rods and tying flies for many, many years.
And fishing, and I think that's the big part of that makes success for any rod company, is that you have a real practical experience and a real connection with the people. That's why I do the sports shows, because I listen to what the people are doing. I listened to a guy yesterday that was really fascinating, older gentleman doing the Euro technique, you know, the check nymphing.
Yep.
And he was really interesting to listen to. So I like
tuned in.
I never took my ears and eyes off of him because he had such great information. And he's like, I'm still learning. And I'm like, yeah. Me too, you know?
Was this a presentation or?
No. He was just came by the booth.
Oh, just a customer.
He was like, you're the first guy to listen to me in a long time. He feels great. I'm like, felt great to learn that. So
that's
yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So it's fun, and you never stop learning. And that's where I look forward to potentially new materials and just new techniques, different things that are happening. And so we build both spinning and casting and the fly stuff. So fishing is fishing.
And speaking of fishing, you were actually on the bass tour for a while, I hear.
I did. I grew up tournament bass fishing, and then I worked my way up into the top ranks, and I fished the FLW Tour in PAA and went back east, had to live, you know, moved to Tennessee and traveled around and did that. And that was really fun and another experience, and nothing easy.
How long were you on the bass tour?
So the Pro Tour back east, I was back there 5 years. And then I came back after that, right around the time of the recession. I came back in 2010.
Okay.
But it was a slippery slope at some point in time. And I just said, I'm coming home.
Yeah, yeah. What was that like? Tell our listeners about some of the experiences you had on the FLW Tour.
Of course, you meet tons of people. You go fish a lake perhaps that you've never seen before. And sometimes you wish you had a fly rod because they're eating little tiny minnows and whatnot, but that's not practical. Fish everywhere from Lake Champlain all the way to Okeechobee and then west really to Oklahoma, Texas, etc. So a lot of fun, met a lot of nice people, sponsor, you learn how to deal with lots of adverse conditions, driving, time management, things like that.
Sponsors?
Sponsors were a big deal. So
talk about the differences here with the traditional rods and bass fishing, and not so much the equipment or the catching, but the understanding of the location of the bass and the behaviors of the bass. I think the traditional bass fishermen, the conventional bass fishermen, are amazing at location and catching of bass. Whereas a lot of times in flies, you know, we do the popper, we hit the shores, but we're not taking into consideration the wind and the temperatures and where the bass are spawning and pre-spawn and post-spawn. I just remember growing up watching the ESPN series of all the FLW tour, and like, these professionals know how to locate and catch bass.
That is the difference between who usually wins at the end of the tournament. It has, the more you know, the less luck plays into it. So knowing the behaviors of any fish, including bass, as to what they're doing at that particular time of the year. What do they do when it's bright, sunny, 100 degrees in July?
Right.
Are they hiding out? Are they deep? So different times, different places. Of course, on the earlier in the year, pre-spawn, they do exactly the same thing they do in the fall. They come up shallow. They follow the bait fish. They feed up before they go spawning. Then they're pretty much negative through the spawn. So I never preferred to fish for spawning fish. I'd rather fish for the ones that were still pre-spawn. Because I felt it was a better use of my time. Of course, I got beat a lot because those guys could go pluck a bigger bag off the nest. It just wasn't my style of fishing.
Yeah.
So after that, then they go into a kind of a post-spawn funk, and then they start to work their way offshore in most cases, sometimes out to a ledge or just maybe some brush or laydowns, and then they go into summer mode, and that's when topwater starts to come and crankbaits and things like that. So, but that's off topic of fly rods, but it's still sort of important in the whole game of fish, whether it be steelhead or whatever. You have to know, or it helps to know, what those fish are doing. And some people, like with the fly, they can just go up to a stream and see what's coming off the hatches, and you know, observation in nature, the time of year, like California, for instance, the shad fishermen go into this time of year watching for the cottonwood coming out of the trees. Soon as that happens, they'll head to the rivers and go fish for American shad.
Amazing.
That are anadromous fish like a steelhead.
Yeah.
And great food fish for bass and stripers. So that's a nature sign that brings you back in. And again, that ties all the way back into making the equipment. You have to know as much as you can know about the environment, the fish, the equipment, why it works, why it doesn't work. And I hear all the time people come by the booth and they say, well, gee, I have this rod and it just doesn't really work for me. And I said, it doesn't matter what brand it is. It does have to speak to you. So, you know, the nice thing about these shows, you go and cast and figure out, you know, what works for you. Typically, the real good casters will love a little bit slower action because they understand it.
That pause,
slow down. A little bit, you know, moderate fast, that's where most people, that's in their wheelhouse.
Yep.
And then super fast is sometimes great casting, great distance, but it doesn't always translate into a great fishing tool.
Well, that is amazing how you brought out some of those characteristics of the bass behavior, because I think as fly fishermen, so often we're so in tune with the trout behavior, and we can understand where that fish is going to be holding in the dry flies or the nymphs or the streamer or an emerger. But I think when it comes to the bass, I think there's a ton that we can learn from the conventional fishermen.
It's true. I took a friend of mine, two friends of mine that are crazy bass fishermen. One lives on the Delta. One fishes the Trophy Lakes in Arizona strictly with a fly. One thing they quickly learned when they bass fish is most of the fish are not caught on the surface. They're caught subsurface. So much like trout, 10% of the time they're feeding on dry flies. The other 90% of the time they're eating a nymph or some fish or crayfish or something swimming around. The bass, we actually went trophy hunting. They wanted to catch a 10-pound bass. We went to Clear Lake for multiple days, and we actually had some really big bass, like plus 8 pounds. But they learned, they used my practical experience from where the fish live and what they're doing, and adapted what flies they were fishing with, big bait fish flies or crayfish patterns, 100% under the surface. So that was really a, you know, more of an eye-opener with them, because I actually brought a conventional rod with a big jig, and while I was sitting in the seat, I was just dragging this jig along, and I caught a plus 8 pounder and another one 7.5 pounds.
Yeah.
Just, they're like, you weren't doing anything. I said, yeah. The inaction sometimes is the action.
Right.
Because they're very curious fish, and if it moves too much, they're like, ah.
Right.
They bust you.
With a bass, there's a lot of pause involved.
There can be, and sometimes it's a reaction.
Yep.
So they're pretty negative, but all of a sudden something goes speeding by them, pops up. They just grab it out of a reaction.
Yeah.
So the fly really is a great way to imitate bait fish, bluegill, crayfish, and you can fish them how they need to be fished.
And so you've done a bunch of guiding, too. You've traveled around the world. We were talking about you've actually fished in over 50 countries.
True enough. Yep.
Amazing. And guided for some, you know, really cool names like John Elway. What was that like, taking him out?
So anytime you deal with the athletes, you're dealing with people that are usually type A.
Yep.
And they're such good athletes that they adapt to fishing very well. So they're fun to go on trips with because they're intense at everything competition. You sit down and play cards, or you go catch fish for tarpon or salmon or whatever. They're into it. One time we went with Mike Shanahan to Alaska. Everybody ate lunch. He went down to the river. He never ate lunch. He just fished all the way through lunch.
The NFL coach.
Yes, because he was so, on all the time.
That's
so
amazing.
It was really fun. You know, I mean, and those are things you never forget. And then
where were you guiding at the time when you were taking out like a John Elway, the quarterback for the Broncos, or Mike Shanahan, the coach from the Broncos?
So I hosted trips in those years, and then I also worked in Alaska. So Northern California, Southern Oregon, or Alaska. So all summer I would work in Alaska.
Good connections there. Good connecting points.
Yeah. Yeah. And then one year after the Gulf War, Norman Schwarzkopf said, hey, I just want to go fishing with my son.
Okay.
So we rode him from the lodge, and the next summer he came out with his son Christian, and we went salmon fishing for a week. So we get touched some really cool people that had some great successes in life, and obviously in that case, you know, protecting a lot of people. So that was neat. So
yeah.
You meet all types of people, young, old, poor, all walks of life.
I think I remember seeing Norman Schwarzkopf on some of the old fly fishing shows on TV on a Saturday morning on like ESPN.
Yes. Love fishing, period. Any kind of fishing. So really intense guy, but true gentleman. And of course, he's not around anymore, but he was a very good sportsman.
The general himself.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the countries you've actually fished in. What are some of the unique countries that maybe somebody might not think about when they go fishing?
So one of the questions oftentimes at home, or you meet people, they say, oh, what's your favorite place to fish? And that's a very hard question to ask. And so I first say warm or cold,
yeah.
Cold water, warm water, or air, northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere. So there's always a lot that goes more into it. So you dial into something that they're more interested in hearing
right.
about. So special place in my heart is always salmon and steelhead. So that's particularly San Francisco to Alaska, but also the Great Lakes as well. I mean, phenomenal fishing like the DSR,
yep.
Salmon River, any of the lakes that flow into the Great Lakes, or any of the rivers that flow into the Great Lakes that hold salmon or steelhead,
yeah.
which you're very familiar with, and everyone is that lives back there
yep.
in the Northeast.
I've enjoyed the tributaries on both Ontario and Erie.
Yes.
And fished the DSR, fished the salmon, but I mean a ton of different tributaries you could fish, and that's a ton of fun. How about out in Asia? Have you fished much in Asia?
I fished in Hong Kong Harbor, where we'd go out at night and we'd fish around the oil rigs or the where they would store the oil and the ships and whatnot. And
what do you fish for?
Really fun. Multitude of species, none of which I could name. You know, they're local fish. Yeah, saltwater fish. But really, really interesting and just another experience. I fished last summer. I was in Korea and I happened to fish the South Han River, and I caught a fish It was only about 4 inches long, but it's so beautiful and colorful. The fellow that I was with had a fly shop in Korea for a long, long time. And he said in 40 years he'd actually never seen one in person.
Oh, wow.
But I took a picture of it because it was the length of the palm of my hand, but it had this brilliant orange stripes and all this stuff on it. So it was just unique, a fish that I took a picture of. And I said, oh, I caught this fish, and here's the picture. And they're like, you know, they went crazy. But then we fished for another fish there. The main fish we were fishing for looked like a bonefish in fresh water. And it was kind of golden. It wasn't sucker-like with the down mouth, but it had a mouth like a bonefish. So it actually ate things, you know, like a bonefish would versus a sucker that just sucked it off the bottom. So
that's neat.
Very interesting. So different places, different times, different things. And then, of course, Africa or Norway or Iceland.
Yeah.
You know, I spent a lot of time over there with those folks. And Costa Rica and Argentina.
Well, let's talk about this fish here. Now, I would recommend that you show this fish. I don't know if you've done this yet, but Jeff Currier, he would be interested to see this fish that you caught.
Yes. He loves, you know, here's another guy that's fished a lot of places and is into that. So I actually probably have a picture of it on my phone for sure on my computer. But
go show
you're
him
right.
before the
I
end
should,
of the day.
I should show him. Yeah, he's really interesting guy and well-spoken in fishing.
Yeah, he
knows.
Caught over 400 species.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody else ever has ever caught that many species on a fly. Over 400 species of fish.
Yeah, that's remarkable. And that's a lot of time and travel and being in dangerous places.
Yep.
So going back to the favorite places, if there's an element of danger, I'm in.
You like that?
Yeah. I don't really particularly like to be bit by things or whatever, but I do.
It kind of turns up the adrenaline a little bit.
Yeah. So one year we were down in Curry Lake in Venezuela, and we were fishing for piranha. But the piranha we were catching, we're going to use for bait when another fish showed up. And so the guide would smash the water, you know, with the paddle and swish the tip in the water. And then once those fish quit biting, then you fish with them for the piara. And I actually took off a piranha by hand, and I have a crescent shaped cut on my finger where the piranha bit me like 450 times.
That's crazy.
You can't see that on the radio, but I can tell you it hurt.
Well, that is nuts, and thank you for sharing some crazy stories with us. I want to go through the different series real quick before we close, Fred, and I want you to help our listeners understand the differences between the series of your rods, because, you know, somebody may see, okay, you got the Sky series, for instance, you have the DXF series or the LRS or the Upstream. Like, talk a little bit about the differences between the series within Douglas.
So within the series of Douglas, it actually goes to a deeper route into the Salmon River and the Barclay family, and they wanted to start a fishing company that sort of catered to not only bringing employment back to the area, but bringing fishing equipment to one of the most populated fishing on the planet, which is the Salmon River.
Right.
So we started with very high utility rods, good value for the money, but, you know, great fishing rods. So we started with the DXF series.
Okay.
Which is today still, you know, 5 years later, one of our most popular lines. We don't discontinue lines every year. So 2 years from now, Rob, if you're, you know, you had a particular 9 foot five weight in the DXF and you told your buddy, you know, 2 years from now, it'd be like, hey, I got that rod. It's not been discontinued 3 years ago.
Yep.
So we try to be consistent, and anytime there's improvement, we'll do that.
Yep.
So we do that. So DXF was our start. We have a new series called LRS, which is our entry level. It's fantastic fishing rods. And one of the things we like to do at Douglas is we don't ever want to cheat somebody out of a fishing experience or casting experience if the economics aren't, you know, or if it's a rod they're only going to use once in a while. It's still a great casting and fishing rod.
And that's the LRS, and that stands for Lake, River, Stream?
Lake, River, and Sea.
Oh, Lake, River, and Sea. Okay.
Yep. So there's a wide variety of rods, both spinning and casting and fly. We have 6 through 10 weight 10 footers that are specifically for the Salmon River, for that Fall King fishing.
Okay.
And then we made another series on the way in. It's called the Upstream series, which is kind of a, not an everyday rod, but it's a small creek rod or small panfish rod. And so they're four piece, they're very delicate, they're spigot ferrule, they're exquisite casting and fishing rod for light tippets. And then with the success of that, we went into Upstream Plus, which we built for the guides and drift boat people and everyday fishermen, 9 foot four, five, and six. Also a little bit slower, beautiful fishing rod. At one point in time, we built the Sky Series. And that's really kind of the neatest story of the short life of Douglas. So David had said, hey, we want to build a high-end series. Okay, so build it really fast. So I built these rods over a couple of years, and we went to the George Anderson who has the shootouts, and he said, oh, these rods are terrible. They're too fast. They're light and they're strong, but they're just way too fast. So after a couple hours of talking, I went back to the drawing board and I said, okay, well, let's make these great fishing rods, still a little bit faster, but very light and very powerful rods. So David says, well, you know, they actually ended up liking the rods at that point in time. And so we brought them out, and he says, well, or about to bring them out. And he said, well, how many will we sell? And I said, well, I don't know. It's going to be a high-end rod. I said, probably try to make it as low price as possible. You know, not go to for $1,000. We don't have the name. Maybe building rods for a long time, but I just don't know how many would sell. But I'll build the best rod of any rod that's ever been built. I'll say that it's going to be fish well and cast well and be a great value for the dollar. So off they came out, about $700 price point. We won a couple of the shootouts, and the stores really, the consumers love them. So that's been a fun ride, and certainly our top-end rod.
But Sky Series.
Yeah, we didn't expect to sell very many, but it's certainly one of our most popular rods.
It's done so well.
Yeah.
And then just to round it out, you have the saltwater, and then you also have these new nymphing rods.
Yeah, so nymphing rods are within the series, so mostly in DXF and okay. In the Sky. We're going to have, I'm working on two 10-foot 6 rods for the LRS series, but those rods are what they would call check nymphing. They're typically 10 to over 11 feet, in our case 10 and 11 feet, and they're designed to fish with really just a leader and some very dense flies, and they're pocket water fishing or target fishing, getting the fly right in. So it's not casting of a fly line, but it's a real effective fishing tool that people have, many places, Colorado and
yeah,
starting in Montana, Pennsylvania,
huge,
Georgia, all over the place. This has really taken hold in America as it did in Western Europe. So it's a neat technique, and it's a whole nother segment of the game. So
you're not building these with like a back cast in mind, like you would in some of your other series.
Well, you still have to do that because people are going to use them traditionally.
They're going
to
still
use them. So they have to do that. But the real element here is they're fast enough action to where they're really sensitive, and you actually will feel the bite or see the bite in the line and react to it.
Yeah.
So it's a neat way to catch mostly trout.
Fun.
Yep. It's a big segment of the game now.
This has been super fun, Fred. I'm so glad to have you on the podcast. And thanks for educating us on rod designing. Being a rod designer, that must be a pretty cool profession.
Yeah, well, getting out to make different things. And when I see people on the river, there was a steelhead derby for 2 days with professional guides and clients on the California and Oregon coast. And our Douglas team won that.
That's cool.
And so that was really neat. And so for me, it's like that personal connection and the folks at the company, all of our people. I mean, we just love to see the smiles. And so Instagram and Facebook, and we tell people when they buy a rod of ours, we're like, hey, you catch some fish or have a good story, let us know, because we want to show what you did, you know, so
yeah.
We love it.
Super fun. How can people find more about you and more about Douglas Rods?
DouglasOutdoors.com.
DouglasOutdoors.com.
Instagram, Facebook, both of those. It's Douglas Outdoors.
Fred, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's been our pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Rob.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.